people who read and people who do. And if you can even read about quantum field theory, it sounds all very reasonable, but you can't actually do anything unless you actually have done it before. And so these exercises are useful in that people say you shouldn't need to learn your times tables because it's rote stuff. But if your timetables aren't kind of in your head, you can't think about the deeper issues when you get to the deeper issues, because it's not, you're always thinking about what the timetables were. And so same thing true with quantum field theory. Basics of, you know, Feynman rules and things like that should just be automatic, and then you can think about the complicated issues. But you want to have the basic stuff just be something which is second nature, and it will never be if you just read about it. So, all right. So, any questions before I start?
So we're going to class next week.
Yep. Not next week. Yeah. No classes on reading week. Yeah. So no classes next Tuesday or next Friday. Thanks for asking. Or you're free to have classes, but I won't be here. So, all right. So. I'll write it on the board here just because the people that are no longer connecting from Guelph, that's the way they can actually see there was one. Remember, assignment 3 is due this coming Friday, but. This coming Friday is 14, 15, 16, 17. So I'll have this up on the webpage again. The first three are on the webpage, and I'll put this one on too. But this particular one is just taken from chapter 5 of the Standard Model book, so it's another way to find it. All right. So we're doing the vacuum polarization, and I had the momentum drawn wrong last time, or somebody cut the error. So I think I had the K going the wrong way, right? I think the right way was that way. Oh, and I think what I did was I had these arrows going the other way. I had it like this, right? That's probably why I had the K wrong. So then we have P prime, P, U. So then we have, here we have P minus K, and here we have P prime minus K. And the bottom line was that this gave us lambda. I can't remember if I called it lambda mu or capital gamma mu. P prime and P was equal to IQ squared over 2 pi, sorry, integral d4k over 2 pi squared. Numerator, and this we have Dirac indices M and N. But divided by a denominator. Excuse me. And the last thing I had last class was what those things were. So we worked out that. So we had N mu was gamma rho minus I P slash prime minus K slash plus M gamma mu minus I P slash minus K slash plus M rho. And the denominator was just the product of the denominators, P minus K.
time you pulled this capital gamma, not capital.
Oh, did I? Yeah, I couldn't remember what I did there. Thanks. Okay, so that's where we were last time. So now all I want to do is just do the, I'll kind of skip some steps, but it'll be the same logic as for the vacuum polarization. So we're going to just make the denominator simple. But before we do that, actually, we'll make this thing simple. The main simplification is we're allowed to use, you know, on the left hand side, we can use the Dirac equation that p slash prime is equal to im. You know, on the left. On the right, we can use that p slash is equal to im. So in this product, so that means that if we could get this p slash past this gamma matrix, we could get rid of it. Or trade it for an M. And so we'll do that. We can also simplify the denominator a little bit because P prime, you know, this means the consequence of this is that P prime squared plus M squared is zero. And a consequence of this is that P squared plus M squared is zero. So we'll use those to simplify the denominators. So the idea is that we're gonna simplify the numerator by taking advantage of this as by moving these guys past the gamma matrices. Then what we'll do is we'll take this denominator and we'll write it in a way which is, we'll use the Feynman parameter trick to write it in a way where it's basically k squared plus something involving only external momenta. So it'll be very symmetric. That'll involve shifting the integration variable k, which we'll have to then track through what it did in the numerator. And then we do the integral over k, taking advantage of the fact that it's a Lorentz invariant. A Lorentz covariant integral, so things linear in k we can kill in the integral over k, and things quadratic in k have a simple form. And then that'll lead us to basically the final form. And then we'll look for the two form factors. We're thinking that this gamma mu will have a piece that looks like gamma mu times f of q squared, where q squared is q will be p prime minus p. And then there's another piece which will be p plus p prime mu g of q squared. So what we'll do is once we've simplified this thing down, we're looking for the answer to have two terms to it, a gamma mu and a p plus p prime mu. And then that'll allow us to pick off what these coefficients are. And this guy is going to be finite, so we're going to be focusing on g. And because of that, I'm going to do all the manipulations of gamma matrices in four dimensions. So we would dimensionally regularize if we're trying to figure out what f is. But for g, because g is finite, we don't really need to regularize, and we'll just do things in four dimensions. Okay, so let's start doing that. So let's start with n mu. And so what we'll do is take advantage of, if we just, you know, we're going to use the fact that basically we know that gamma mu is equal to 2 a to mu nu. So that means that, you know, a slash b slash plus b slash a slash is equal to 2 a dot b. And so I can always reverse the order, paying the price of a sign, and there's always a piece to do with dot product. So what I'll do is we'll write gamma rho you know, minus I p slash prime plus m. So the m doesn't care about the gamma rho, but the p slash prime, if I use this trick, that'll be plus I p slash prime gamma rho. And then I'll have a minus 2i p prime rho plus m gamma rho. All right, so this is just using this. And so you see that these two, so we got what we want here. We have I p slash prime plus m gamma rho minus 2i p rho prime. So this is something which is zero on the left because that's using that. And all we have need to keep is that. And there's a similar story here that I can pull the p slash past the gamma rho. So we have minus I p slash plus m gamma rho is going to be gamma rho I p slash plus m. Minus 2i p lower row. And again, we can get rid of that. So that means that we can rewrite n mu in that way. It's going to be, so the k slash, you know, nothing happens to them, so they just have to keep them. So we'll have a, we'll have, on the left, we'll have this minus 2i p prime row coming from these guys. And then we'll also have a minus gamma row k slash I plus. Then we have gamma mu. And on this side, we have, I guess, plus I k slash gamma rho minus 2i u rho. Which we could just, there's, so there's four terms here, right? So let's just multiply them out. This one times this one will be minus 4 p dot p prime gamma mu. So that was that times that. That times that will be plus 2 gamma mu k slash p slash prime is that times that. So we've done that guy now. This guy times this guy will be plus 2 p slash k slash gamma mu. And this guy times this guy will be minus gamma rho k slash gamma mu k slash gamma rho. That's not what I got when it is before. So what happened there? Oh, yeah, well. So actually, in my notes, what I did was I pulled the k slash past the gamma rho the same way. So this whole story here, so what do I actually, so p minus k p prime . So the thing is, we'll have a, it's hard to believe this is helping us at all, but it's not going to hurt, I guess. So this is equal to 0. We have this p prime minus k rho. And then the thing that's missing here is now the k slash with the other side. So we'll have minus, let me, instead of modifying a line, let me just write the whole line again. Where's the brush? So I'm not doing anything conceptually complicated here. I'm just including the k term that I left out before. So we got the thing where we change the sign. We got plus I p slash prime minus k slash plus m gamma rho. Then we have the thing where we have the dot product. So we have 2 minus 2i p prime minus k rho. That's it. And if we did the same thing here, we would have had minus I p slash minus k slash plus m. So that just changes what I write here a little bit. So we have minus 2i prime minus k rho you know, here we have that we still get to use p slash plus m is equal to 0 and p slash plus m is equal to 0. So the thing we have to keep here is we still have, I just have the k slash on the opposite side of gamma rho now. So I've got minus I k slash gamma rho. And then here we have the same story. We've got the minus 2i k minus k rho. And here we've got the minus I k slash on the right. So let's just do this again. So this times this will be as before. It'll be minus 4 p prime minus k dot p minus k. This times this will be minus 2 p slash prime minus k slash times k slash. This times this will be minus 2 k slash p slash minus k slash. Oh, I forgot the gamma mu. Gamma mu here would be to the left. And here gamma mu would be to the right. And then the last one is this one times this one. So we have minus k slash gamma rho gamma mu gamma rho k slash. And this is, so the reason why it was better to do it this way than what I did before is that this is an easier thing to deal with because the k slashes are on the outside. So one thing we can use is that k slash times k slash, that's just k mu, k nu times gamma mu, gamma nu. So that's because that's symmetric under mu goes to nu. That's 1/2. I can replace gamma mu, gamma nu by the half the commutator. And then that's just the metric. So that's 1/2 k mu, k nu times twice a to mu nu. So that's basically k squared. So that makes these terms simple. So let's write that out. So we have n mu is minus 4 p prime minus k dot p dot k. And here we have minus 2 gamma mu p slash prime plus 2 gamma mu k squared minus 2 k slash p slash gamma mu. I lost something here, right? Yeah, 2 gamma mu p slash prime k slash. And then we have a plus 2 gamma mu k squared. And I've done that right. So there's a plus here too. These things didn't cancel. Yeah, good. And then here, so gamma, if we just do the same thing, gamma rho, gamma mu, gamma rho. If we had the gamma rhos next to each other, gamma rho with gamma rho, that's just eta mu nu times gamma mu, gamma nu. So that's 1/2 eta mu nu times the commutator of gamma mu, or anti-commutator of gamma mu, gamma nu. And so that's eta mu nu times eta mu nu. So that's 4. So if we have two gamma h's next to each other where we can track the rows, we just get a number. In this case, we don't quite have that, but we have almost that if we could anti-commute things. So what we should just do is we'll use this rule here for anti-commuting things. So this is going to be minus gamma mu, gamma rho, plus here we would have had twice eta mu rho, gamma rho. So I've just taken that product of on the left-hand side, and I've used, you know, this basically. So this we've just seen over here is 4, because of that argument here. So what we have is this is equal to minus 4 gamma mu plus 2 gamma mu. So this is equal to minus 2 gamma mu. So altogether, we've got n mu is minus 4 p prime minus k dot p minus k gamma mu. Now we have this thing twice, right? We have that plus that is plus 4 k squared gamma mu. That guy, we've got that guy, we got that guy. Then we have minus 2 gamma mu p slash k slash minus 2 k slash p slash gamma mu. Does that look like what I got here? Minus 4, minus 2. And I had the last term, I forgot it, right? That thing here, right? It's plus 2 k slash gamma mu k slash. Yeah. Now, we still win by putting p slash to the left, right? So if we make p slash prime to the left, we can use that p slash prime is equal to im if it's on the left. And here again, p slash on the right. So what we can do in this one is we can take minus 2 gamma mu p slash prime k slash. And we'll, for this two factors, we'll use what we've been doing right along. So that's plus 2 p slash prime gamma mu k slash. But we have to then put in the metric piece, so it's minus 4 p prime mu k slash. And this we can write as being, that'll be 2im mu k slash minus 4 p prime mu k slash. And the similarly over there, when we have minus 2 k slash p slash gamma mu, that'll be plus 2 k slash gamma mu p slash minus 4 k slash p mu. So that'll be 2im k slash gamma mu minus 4 k slash p mu. So far so good. Okay, so the next good thing is that when we add these together, as we're supposed to, right, this one plus this one, add that to that, this with this involves gamma mu k slash plus k slash gamma mu, so that's just actually twice k mu. So the sum, we'll have 4im k mu minus 4 p prime mu k slash minus 4 k slash p mu. So another way of writing that is that that's 4 minus 4 p prime plus p mu k slash. So you see we're starting to get things that look like what we want. We're looking for pieces that look like p plus p prime mu, and we're looking for things that look like gamma mu, and so we're getting some of those as well. So that's, so we just did those two. K squared gamma mu. And here we might as well also simplify things. So if we could take 2 k slash gamma mu k slash. Again, if we change the order, we can trade this for k squared. So this will be minus 2 gamma mu k slash plus 4 k mu k slash. So that'll be minus 2 k squared gamma mu plus 4 k mu k slash. So if we, you see that the minus 2 k squared gamma mu will come with this one and it'll reduce the 4 to 2. And then the k slash k mu term will combine with nothing. Yeah. So altogether, what we have is n mu is minus 4 p prime minus k dot p minus k gamma mu. And we have the 4k squared minus the 2k squared, so we get plus 2k squared gamma mu. We got this guy, and that guy, and that guy. And then we have the minus 4 p prime plus p mu k slash. That's this guy. We got the 4im. Mu, that's that guy. That now is these two guys. And all we're missing is this guy. So is that what I got here? Yes, yes. 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 So let's just leave that there for now. That's kind of the simplified form. And now let's go to the denominator. So the denominator, the goal with the denominator is, if you're doing these integrals over momenta over k, this is a bitch because you've got k, you know, k is linear, not just quadratic in the denominator. So the Feynman trick is designed to make, you know, you introduce a couple of new integrals, the Feynman parameters, in such a way as that makes the denominator purely quadratic in k. So what we'll use is the Feynman trick here in this case for three. Here we have three denominators. We didn't have this many denominators in the vacuum polarization. But when Leo did it, there was a Feynman trick that worked for n denominators. So we'll use that one. So we're going to use that 1 over d. This is the Feynman trick. So 1 over d, which is that thing we had over there in the denominator. We can write that as twice the integral from 0 to 1 dx, the integral from 0 to x of dy of 1 over a new denominator, which is, so I probably want to have a curly bracket here. So I've got p prime minus k squared plus m squared minus I epsilon times y plus p minus k squared plus m squared minus I epsilon times x minus y plus k squared minus I epsilon 1 minus x. And then this is cubed. So the curly bracket here is the it doesn't look like we've made much progress because we still have things involving k's linearly, but the point will be that when we expand this out, because we're adding them all together now, that things will simplify. So the curly bracket there in the denominator is, if you just let's just write it everywhere out. So we've got p prime squared minus 2 p prime dot k plus m squared. I'll drop the I epsilons for now. P squared minus 2 p dot k k squared, m squared. Now the p prime squared plus m squared we can drop because that's the on-shell condition for the external momentum line, or the Fermion line. Sorry? Oh, I missed the k squared. Thank you. So the P and the M's are dropping out because that's the on-shell condition for the fermion line. And we can group the K's. We have K squared times Y plus X minus Y plus 1 minus X. So we've got that guy, and that guy. And then there's a P dot K term here, which is minus 2 K dot, we've got P prime times Y plus P times X minus Y. So the good, so the Y cancels the Y, the X cancels the X, and we just have K squared, which is nice. And so now it's, you can't stop yourself from completing the square there. So the curly bracket is going to be K minus P prime Y minus P X minus Y. Let's call it square bracket squared. So the K squared term we have, the cross term we have, and so all we're getting wrong here is those guys squared. So we have to subtract those. So I'm going to call this plus A squared, and I'll put back in the minus I epsilon, where A squared here is just the thing I just said. It's minus this thing squared, P prime Y plus P X minus Y squared. And I've written it in this way where it looks positive because these are basically time-like momenta. Remember, P squared is negative for a time-like four vector. This is a four vector, which is a linear combination of P and P prime, both of which are time-like. And so its square is going to want to be negative. And so that's why I'm writing it with a plus sign here. Although that's not going to be really important in what we do. So that means that this denominator was really easy, right? So it's become, if we call this K twiddle or something, then this would be 1 over D is twice integral from 0 to 1 dx. Integral from 0 to x dy of 1 over k twiddle squared plus a squared minus I epsilon cubed. So that's nice and symmetric. So what we want to do is we want to take k and write it as being k twiddle plus px plus p prime by p prime y. P x minus y. And so what we'll do is we'll make this substitution in the numerator, n. So this is where was our numerator? For all these k's here, we're going to want to trade them for this k twiddle, because this is the one that's going to have a simple integral. It'd be, once you've made the denominator quadratic in k, then when we do an integral d4k, if the numerator has something which has got an odd number of, the numerator is a polynomial, right? It's a polynomial in K. So all the odd powers of K twiddle have to vanish because we're doing a Lorentz invariant integral and there's no tensor it could be equal to. So let me write that explicitly. So we're gonna take K goes to K twiddle and n mu of k. And what we're going to use is the property that if the integral d4k twiddle divided by the denominator, because it's such a simple denominator, times k twiddle mu is 0. It's a symmetric integration region, and this is odd under k goes to minus k. And the same thing's true for odd powers, right? This is the integral d4k twiddle. And what was the order of the polynomial we're talking about? We have something which is at most quadratic in K. So we don't actually need to know we didn't need to know this, but it's true. But we also know what the integral is when we have two of them. D4K twiddle over D. You know, if we've, any term like that which has a k mu, k nu, all these other things that are multiplying k mu and k nu are matrices that are not depending on the integral, you can take them outside the integral. The denominator is a simple function of k. And so this thing is a number. This integral is something which doesn't depend on any of the other variables like p or p prime. So the only thing it can possibly be, given that it's Lorentz invariant, is the metric, right? It has to be some number times eta mu nu because of Lorentz invariants. And so the number, we know what it is because since it's only one number, we can take the trace of this equation and find out what the number is. So 4a has to be equal to the integral d4k twiddle over d of k twiddle squared. So that means that we can take k twiddle mu, k twiddle nu, and replace it by 1/4 k twiddle squared eta mu nu in mu. So that'll simplify things a lot, right? Because we the various places where k mu, k nu are contracted with different tensors, now the contraction will just be involved k twiddle squared. All right, so there's some algebra you do. You kind of stick this shift into here, use those two rules, and I'll just tell you what you get, because it's, where are we here? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, so the upshot is that n mu becomes, so you get minus 4 p prime 1 minus y minus p x minus y dot p 1 minus x minus y x plus y minus p prime y times gamma mu minus 4k squared gamma mu plus 4i m 1 plus x p prime y plus p x minus y mu minus 4i m x p plus p prime mu minus 2 k squared minus a squared. And these are k twiddle squareds. Gamma mu plus k twiddle squared gamma mu. So you remember our goal is we're looking for these two form factors, gamma mu and p plus p prime, and we're almost there because this is a contribution to gamma mu. This is a gamma mu. This is a p plus p prime. Those are gamma mu's. The only thing that doesn't have the form we want is that one. But we can rewrite it to look like p plus p prime, and that's because we have a lot of freedom. There's a certain amount of freedom in the x and the y integrals. So what we'll do in that that one term is we'll do a change of variables for y. We're looking for g. Yeah, if we've been doing f, then this would have been 1 over d here. Yeah, and then you would have to follow through what happens. So I should emphasize that. All right, so what we'll do is let's do the change of variables. You know, this term is the one that's the problem. And what we have is the integral dx from 0 to 1, integral from 0 to x dy of 1 plus x p prime y plus p x minus y mu divided by, I'm going to stop writing k twiddle, or I might forget to. I'll write it now, but if it happens and I start forgetting, then So I've rewritten it a little bit in that you know, remember a squared was this thing squared? And so I've just taken places where I had p prime and p squared and replaced those by m squareds. And where I have p minus p prime, I'm calling that q. So q here is, so it's the same thing, but I just rewrote it a little bit. Now the purpose of the exercise is that what we'd like to do, you know, if we had had in this term, if this had been a y, we would have been happy. So what we'll do is I want to do the change of variables where, make sure I say this right, where we take y goes to x minus y. I guess if this one had been x minus y. Change variables. And the point of that is that we just have to do that for this term. And the denominator is invariant under that change, because basically x goes to x minus y, nothing happens there. And I don't do anything to x. So the upshot of that is that for this part of the integral, I can for free replace this by x minus y. And having done that, then the x minus y comes up front, and we have a combination which is p plus p prime squared, p plus p prime. So then we'll have integral. X. Oh, sorry, there's no square there. So up here, we can just pull out the x minus y. So now it's easy to read off what's F and what's G. And so I'm going to focus on G. So the things that are relevant for G are just basically these two terms, right? So there's also a conventional factor of 1 over 2m. Remember, the thing that we're looking for here was it was something like minus I over 2m. P plus P prime. So if we take those factors out, then this is what we get for G. So G of Q squared is going to be minus 2i times the charge squared times 8m squared over 2 pi to the fourth. Let me write 2 pi to the fourth somewhere else. So let me write this. I can see when I wrote this, I wrote it in two steps, and so the 8 and the 2 we can make into a 16 if we want. Times we have a total of y 1 plus x minus x over h to the squared plus m squared. And yeah. So here, you know, basically there's the why is an m squared rather than an m? That looks wrong. So I think this should be an m, because I'm looking at the m we're following is this m. Oh, this is 1 over 2m. Thank you. Yeah, good. One check is dimensions. The whole thing should be dimensionless. That's a mass squared. That's mass to the fourth. So we got mass to the sixth. We got mass to the sixth. Yeah, so that's also right. And this integral should converge, as it does, because it's a d4k, and it's a 1 over k to the 6th. Now, you remember what we wanted for the anomalous magnetic moment. We didn't need all of g of q squared. We only needed g of 0, right? So you can do the k-integral. I can't remember if I did the k-integral here or not. You know, it's just basically a polynomial in k. Yeah, I might as well do the k-integral. So basically, the integral, I'm going to use the fact that integral d4 k twiddle over k twiddle squared plus a squared cubed, that's equal to I pi squared over 2a squared. And if we use that, then we've got g of q squared. You know, and this I is coming in because I'm going to wick rotate to Euclidean signature like Leo did in the vacuum polarization. And that'll give us a factor of I, which is that factor of I. And then the integral, the remaining integral we're doing is just an elementary one. So we've got now 8 q squared m squared pi squared over 2 pi to the fourth times the integral from 0 to 1 dx, integral from 0 to x dy of y 1 plus x minus x divided by m squared plus q squared y x minus y squared, sorry. And again, the dimensions, that's the mass squared. It's a mass squared, that works. And I think there's one last kind of tweak. So what we do is we can do a change of variables. The denominator, take y goes to x minus y. Again, that's invariant. So we can use that to simplify the numerator. And if we do that, then we can write this instead of this. I can write it as basically there's going to be a sign that goes down. So let me write that right the next line. So it's minus q squared m squared over 4 pi squared. So that's just the change of variables gives you that. So this is our our final thing. Okay, so is there a board here I haven't used yet? Probably not. So we can read off immediately what the anomalous magnetic moment is for at one loop for the mu for the any fermion. So remember that we had that the magnetic moment was q over 2m 1 minus g of 0. And we called that this factor here we called, for historical reasons, the g factor was twice 1 minus g of 0. So for that, we want to know what g minus 2 is, which is the way that this is quoted typically. It'll be minus 2 g of 0. So g of 0, just from the other board, is it's a much simpler integral, right? It's just minus q squared m squared. Yeah?
How did you draw a box around those two terms?
Because those are the ones, everybody else is proportional to gamma mu. So those are all contributions to f of q squared. And I just want to follow now g of q squared. That's those guys. So I guess the m squared cancels. We'll have integral dy zero to x of 1 plus x, 1 minus x over x. And I can't do integrals in my head, so I'll just tell you what that is. That's minus q squared over 8 pi squared. Actually, that's an easy integral to do. So, if q were minus e as it is for an electron, then this would have been minus e squared over 8 pi squared. And e squared over 4 pi squared is what we called alpha, right? So this would be minus alpha over 2 pi. So this, in that case, would have been, so this factor here, 1 minus g, is 1 plus alpha over 2 pi in that case. And this becomes alpha over pi because of the factor of 2. And those are famous expressions for g minus 2 and the anomalous magnetic moment. If you take the, I meant this morning, and I got distracted by something else, to look up what the modern value is for g minus 2. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the value, the experimental and numerical value and the theoretical value that were true 30 years ago when I was a graduate student, and they're already impressive, but they're better now. And so what I'm giving you are really old numbers here, and I just forgot to dig out the numbers this morning, for which I apologize. So it turns out that it's known, the corrections, so that's the one loop correction, but the accuracy of the measurements is much better than one loop, so people have to go past one loop. And what we know, what's known is that 1 minus g of 0 for electrons, it's equal to 1 plus alpha over 2 pi, which is what we just calculated. And then there's a piece which is alpha squared over pi squared. And it has a closed form answer, turns out, which is not very common. Plus pi squared over 12 plus 3 quarters. The zeta function evaluated at 3. And this is the numerically the biggest part. And that whole thing, you just evaluate it, it's minus 0.328. And then the next term would be, alpha to the fourth order. Sorry, I meant to write alpha cubed. Thanks. So numerically, if you evaluate this, think just what I wrote here, this would be equal to 1.00115969, given how well we know what alpha is. And so the experimental value 30 years ago was 1.00115965567 with the error of 35 in the last decimal place. So you see that it works really well. It's amazing. And it's one of the classic tests of quantum field theory. It's also been measured for muons. And for muons, there's a... For muons, the story that we looked at would be the same. But this two-loop story is different, and it's different in the sense, the most important thing is that there's a two-loop graph. So here we have a muon, and we have the vacuum polarization. But you have a two-loop graph where you have an electron inside the vacuum polarization. So in here, if everybody's an electron, that's just part of what we did. But when the muon and electron are there together, there's a part of the answer depends on the logarithm of the electron to the muon mass. And that's an example of a large logarithm. And that's actually the biggest part of the answer. So for muons, there's a piece in here which is the analog of this would be 1 minus g of 0 would be 1 plus alpha over 2 pi plus alpha squared over pi squared. So there's minus 0.328 plus 1/3 log 2 minus 25 over 36 plus 1/6 the log of mu squared over me squared. And this is big. And so we're going to come back to how do you find these logs, because it's useful to find these logs because they can often be the biggest thing in your answer. And numerically, this is 1.00165546. And the experiment 30 years ago was 1.00116616. Error 31. So again, it works really well. No, yeah, order alpha cube. And this is what's called a large log. Any questions about that? So that's kind of a classic loop calculation. And it what's nice about quantum electrodynamics is that all these loops you do, the Lamb shift loop, the self-energy or the vertex correction loop, they're really exquisitely measurable. And the agreement works exquisitely well. And so you really believe this is doing a good job of describing what you see in nature. OK. So this point is where a natural place to change topics. And so this is, I told you I was going to go back and fill in some holes that I thought there were of background information. Because the next topics, the natural ones to talk about would be things like the Lehmann-Chalain representation and things that are kind of non-perturbative and exact statements you can make about propagators. But for their context, you really need to have a sense as to the framework in which you're calculating matrix elements and correlation functions in field theory. So I'd like to go back now and fill in the things that I thought should be filled in. And there's three things in that filling in that I want to do. So the three things are, I want to do the stupid calculation of if you had been the person inventing quantum mechanics and relativity, what you would have said for electromagnetism, what you would have said the propagator would have been. And I want to show you that it's uglier than you thought it was, probably. And then so it's going to look like Lorentz invariance is a miracle. And that's kind of the spirit of this assignment I'm handing out here. So we're going to do a three-part aside. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take, the electromagnetic potential. So if you just sat down and said, what fields can represent massless spin one particles? You're asking a group theory question, because you're asking for a field, and the fields, you know how they transform under Lorentz transformations. They transform in some finite dimensional representation. And you're asking how do they get expanded in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And the creation and annihilation operators, you also know how they transform under Lorentz transformations. They transform in unitary representations. And so the unitary representations are not finite dimensional, and so they can't be the same representations of the fields. But if you're writing something that transforms in one representation as linear combinations of things transforming in a different representation, the coefficient is a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. And so it's a group theory exercise to figure out the coefficient. And that's what you're doing when you're finding what fields represent which particles. So when you write something like phi of x for a scalar field is the integral d3p over the square root of, there's a bunch of conventional factors here, times a of p, e to the I px plus the antiparticle part, say. These coefficients here, the e to the I px and this, it's all Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, because this thing is transforming as a scalar field, which is a specific finite dimensional representation of Poincaré transformations. This is transforming as a spin zero particle. And the coefficients are dictated by Lorentz invariance and translation invariance up to normalization. And there's a conventional normalization that we choose, which is the canonical normalization. So the main message there is that it's, It's not like a, it's a, not a mystery. You tell me a particle, its spin and its mass. You give me a random field, and I can tell you whether or not there exists an expansion, because sometimes the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient will be zero, and then there won't exist an expansion. Sometimes there will exist an expansion. And so that's how you identify which fields are the ones for which it's possible to represent which particles. And for massless spin 1 particles, the simplest field that you find in that way is F mu nu of x, which is the, you know, comes to you as the curl of something. And the something it's the curl of is has an expansion like this, whose coefficients are dictated by group theory. And so it's a sum over the two polarizations, plus or minus 1, you know, integral d3p of the square root of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy, times a polarization vector, which depends on p and lambda. There's a p. And these polarization vectors are not random things. They're the things that are given to you as the solution to this Clebsch-Gordan problem. And so you can write them down. Excuse me. And so the polarization vectors are the things that you're used to expecting. So epsilon mu for if we take the momentum, let's say, to lie in the z direction, so it's p, the unit vector in the z direction, then the polarization vector, so let's write that as a, so it's there'll be some energy p, 0, 0. So this is, I'm imagining this is time x, y, and z. So for a photon, you know, the energy is equal to the momentum. So epsilon mu in that case for lambda equals, for that momentum, this particular momentum, when lambda is equal to plus or minus 1, is just, you know, 1 over root 2. It's something which lives only in the xy direction because it's transverse. So it's 0, 1, plus or minus I, 0, say. And that's the answer. And you have some choice as to what your basis is of polarization vectors. It could be linearly polarized or circularly polarized. But this is a circular choice, and you didn't have any options about putting things in the zeros here. And so you might have, I told you that you're led to this field when you ask this Clebsch-Gordan question, but then I'm writing down this field, and you might have said, well, so I lied to you, you're really led to this field. But this field with this polarization vector is not a 4 vector. If I do a Lorentz transformation on this particle state and ask, how does this field transform? It transforms like a 4 vector up to the gradient of something. And so although this is not a 4 vector, this is a tensor because the gradient drops out. And so the gauge invariance is coming to you. If you build things that have a mu, they will only be Lorentz invariant if you're thinking of a mu as a 4 vector, if they were also gauge invariant, because this is not a 4 vector. So I've said that before. But so the three steps in this three-part aside are this. Yeah, there were no options here. So this is what you find for spin 1 particle. So what we'll do is in the first step is we'll calculate the time ordered product, the propagator basically for a mu of x, a nu of y in the vacuum. That's the thing we've been calculating when we calculate a propagator. And it'll come to us as, you know, an integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. And there'll be a 1 over p squared minus I epsilon. And there'll be some numerator here, which, I don't know, we'll call it n mu nu or something, a p. And this n mu nu is going to be something which you might have thought would be, you know, I've been talking about it like it's eta mu nu plus p mu alpha nu plus alpha nu p mu. Sorry, alpha mu p nu. Or maybe it might also be a p mu, p nu term. I've been talking about it like it always has p's somewhere. And these p's, when they hit some other thing, give you something which is vanishing because of gauge invariance or current conservation. But that's not what you actually find. When you calculate this n, you find there's a piece which is, there's a piece like this, there's a piece like this, but there's also a piece which is not like any of those things, which contributes to stuff in a non-covariant way. So it's something which only appears in the mu equals zero part of the propagator. So it's explicitly a not covariant thing. And that's a problem because you make these Feynman rules and you calculate scattering amplitudes. And the propagators were designed to be the combination of virtual states which transform covariantly. When we had a scalar field here and we didn't have this numerator, or we had a spin half field where we had the Dirac matrix numerator, it was nice and covariant. And when we use it in amplitudes, we get covariant stuff. But this extra piece that I'm alluding to here that we're going to calculate screws up your covariance. It gives you some non-covariant turd that just sits there in your calculation. And what happens in quantum electrodynamics is that you have to have a non-invariant term in your interaction Hamiltonian that is systematically going through and canceling that. And that non-covariant interaction is what you would call the Coulomb interaction, it turns out. So it turns out that the Coulomb interaction in quantum electrodynamics, from the point of view of Lorentz invariance, plays the role of the thing that goes through and removes this non-covariant part of your propagator everywhere. But it's a miracle. It looks like a miracle. So if you were just starting from scratch, you would have to make up non-covariant terms in your interaction Hamiltonian if you're just doing quantum mechanics. And it would look very odd that things were Lorentz invariant at the end of the day. So the first message will be, there is a turd here to not step in. The second message will be, you know, why do you do canonical quantization when you're doing field theory? The reason you do canonical quantization is it gives you the terms that you need to cancel these turds. So the canonical quantization, its rationale, or one of its rationales, is that it's the thing that tells you how to make these weird Hamiltonian interactions, which will save your Lorentz invariance by canceling the failures of your propagator to be Lorentz, to be covariant. So canonical quantization provides, so I should say here that there is a non-covariant, we're going to show there's a non-covariant part to this, which must cancel a non-covariant interaction. Canonical quantization gives you a simple rule for figuring out what these propagators are, but also figuring out what the interactions are that fix the ugliness of the propagators. So, algorithm finding both this kind of a rule, if you don't want to do it as a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, both the terms A, B, lambda. So that's the thing that gives you the propagator, which gives you these things that are not covariant. But it also gives you the non-covariant interactions that fix the failure, that cancel non-covariant terms in A mu, A mu. And then the third step in this aside will be, so that's more systematic, but still ugly, because it's like you're carrying around things that you don't need. That there's, you've got a covariant part to your propagator and a non-covariant part. The non-covariant part is there if you calculate the propagator, but it's systematically canceling a non-covariant part in your interactions, leaving only the effects of the invariant. So your interactions come to as being an invariant piece and a non-invariant piece. And the non-invariant pieces are just systematically canceling a bunch of non-invariant pieces of your propagators. Wouldn't it be nice if you just had a framework which only involved the covariant pieces and didn't force you to keep track of the things that we're going to cancel anyway? And that's what path integrals are for. So the path integral, because it allows you to phrase things directly in terms of the Lagrangian, it'll both set up propagators which are covariant and interactions that are covariant in such a way that everything's explicitly manifestly covariant at every step. And these magic cancellations that you would see in the operator language you don't have to worry about it because they've been done for you once and for all. Provides an algorithm for cutting to the chase. You only use covariant propagators. And so those are sometimes called, in the old days, if you wrote a T star product, if you had a, instead of writing a time ordered product of two fields, like A mu of X and A nu of Y, sometimes people would write what they called a T star product. And the T star product was, you do the time ordering, but you throw away the non-covariant part, was more or less the rule. And the path integral just gives you this. So it's something where you don't have to worry about the non-covariant part. And invariant interactions. So that's the motivation of the three steps. And I'll start off with this one now. And hopefully I can get to the end of it. But then the next thing will be do QED again canonically, where you'll see that you get not only this expansion, but you also get an interaction Hamiltonian. For QED, it's going to turn out that the interaction Hamiltonian will be minus the integral of, you know, J mu times A mu, the thing that looks covariant, plus the Coulomb interaction. And this explicitly non-covariant piece is the thing that's going through and removing the badness of the propagator. And so if you calculated everything with the T star product here, the covariant part of the propagator, and this interaction, you would get the right answer because the thing that you failed to include here is canceling the thing you failed to include here. But if you actually follow your nose, they're all there and you'd have to keep track of them. So the first thing I want to show you is that there's a funny thing. Once you've got vectors and higher, it doesn't happen for spin a half or spin zero, but for vectors and higher, there's a covariance problem in the propagator. And related to that, there's a non-Lorentz invariant interactions of the Hamiltonian. All right, so it's clear where we're going. That's kind of what the message will be. So let's start with the first part of it. That's so this is the part that, you know, it's often not taught in field theories because once, it's kind of like, you know, it's the old thing, Jesus dying for your sins. Once it's happened once, you don't have to do it over and over again. And so in this case, once you know that there's an algorithm, once you know that there's a good way of doing things, people normally go right there and they don't tell you why they're going there. But there are times when you're thinking in terms of operators that you need to be more careful about the connection between path integrals and operators. And it's good to know that there was an issue that it was, you know, that the heroes in the days of yore solved for you. That the solution is this. And it's good to see when we do exact statements, how to relate what you normally do to what you like to think about when you think in terms of operators. Okay. So for the first part, what we want to do is just take this expression. So we're going to start with this. We're going to use this polarization vector, and we'll just calculate this. And we'll calculate it in the stupid way. You know, we have the A's in terms of creation and destruction operators. Whenever a destruction operator hits the vacuum, it gives you zero. Whenever a creation operator hits the vacuum on the other side, it's the complex conjugate of the destruction operator hitting this vacuum, and so it gives you zero. And so you evaluate this thing by taking all the A's and A daggers and moving them using their commutation relations to the left and right so that they give you zero. And whatever is left by their failure to commute is what the answer was. And so that's how we pick off what this thing is. That's what Feynman rules are really tracking all the time. So if we calculate the time-ordered product, so that'll be, the time ordering says that we're supposed to order these things differently depending on who's at a later time and who's at an earlier time. So we have a step function here, you know, where step function is, you know, theta of S is 1 if S is bigger than 0, and 0 if S is less than 0. So it's going to be theta of x naught minus y naught times the sum of the polarizations. We get integral d3p times these factors, which are coming from the normalizations there. 2π/3/2. I've got two of them, so I guess I get 2π³. E to the I p dot x minus y. We have epsilon nu star. I get lower. Of lambda. And then we have the other term. So there's a term like this where x is later than y. And there's another term when they're the opposite order, which I'll just write as x goes to y. So everything there we know, right? It's just a matter of algebra. All those ingredients are dictated to us by general principles, and so we just calculate this thing. So we can write this as, so the idea is I'm going to write this as much like a, the only thing that's going to spin one here is this sum, we have a sum over these polarization vectors. And the rest of the stuff would have been there for a scalar field. So we can write this thing as what you would have had for a scalar field times what's left. So we'll have a 1 over 2π³ integral d3p over twice the momentum theta of x naught minus y naught So that's what you would have had for a scalar. And then this rest of the thing we'll call n mu nu p. And it's just this polarization sum. And as a matrix, so if we use, if we're in a frame where the momentum is this momentum here. So the thing is, we know what this is in a particular frame. In a general frame, you get it by doing the Lorentz transformation of that frame. But in this frame, it's easy to write down what that polarization sum is. It's going to be something which is a unit matrix basically in the x, y direction, and it'll be zero in the other two directions. So this thing will be, in that basis, will be the matrix, you know, if this is time x, y, and z, it'll be the matrix 0, 0, 0, 0. And in here we'll have 1, 0, 0, 1. So in the two-dimensional space spanned by the polarizations, this is a completeness statement that they sum up to one if you sum over both polarizations. So if you want to write that in a more general frame, what you can do is first thing you can do is you can kind of take P away from the Z direction. And all this is saying is that we're looking for a matrix which is perpendicular to P because it's in the direction, space direction perpendicular to P, and it has nothing in the time direction. All right, so in a general frame where P is some random vector, the P naught in Z direction, then N, you know, 0i would be 0, and that would be N I 0, and that would be also N 0, 0. And then Nij, where I and j are space directions, it's just something which is perpendicular to P, right? So it'll be delta ij minus pi, pj, and then I want to have things be normalized, so I'll have to subtract off, say, p squared. I think I did that right. So what I'm doing is essentially taking out the unit vector in the z direction, in the momentum direction. Now, if you want to go to a general Lorentz frame where time and space get mixed up, we can do that too, just by putting in a four vector which captures what that frame was here that we were working in before. So what I'd like to do, you know, the way we're going to get this in a general frame is we're going to take this answer and go to a general frame And it's hard to do that with this thing because it's been written in terms of three vectors, not four vectors. So we can write this in terms of four vectors. What we'll do is let's use the n mu. So if they take this to be the thing which defines the frame in which time is time and space is space in this calculation we did up here, let's define n to be this for this calculation. And then p mu we'll take to be p0 free momentum, where the free momentum is what we had here. Then another way of writing what n is it's n mu nu is a to mu nu plus n mu p nu plus n nu p mu times p0 minus p mu p nu over three momentum squared plus p alpha, so that's really p squared times n mu n nu over three momentum squared. So the claim is if we use this literal vector and this literal vector here, we get this. But the advantage of writing this is that in a general frame, we were supposed to take this and we were supposed to do the Lorentz transformation of all these vectors to see what they were in the new frame. And that would tell us what the answer was in an arbitrary frame. And this is something which is easy to do because here everybody is transforming like a four vector, so you know how to Lorentz transform it. So if you want to know what this is in some random frame, you just Lorentz transform all these four vectors from this frame where you had chosen it to whatever the frame is that you'd like to evaluate things in. And so you can see the problem already here because this is something which we had been talked about before. That's the thing we've always been keeping. This is something which is also something we've talked about before because there's always a p mu or a p mu or a p mu p mu. So that's something which the gauge invariance was killing for us before. But this is the turd. This is the thing that is not, there's no p mu's and p mu's here. And so it's the thing that is the problem. This is not covariant. In this frame, it's pure time. It's the only thing that survives is the time direction. If this is time, x, y, and z. So it's a non-covariant contribution to a0, and not to the spatial parts. And it's worth, before we stop, writing it out in position space, because it'll help you see what's going to cancel it. So, yeah.
Looks like it wouldn't be because you got p zeros and.
Oh, you don't care though because the gauge invariance saves you. It's always something times p mu or p nu, and that's always hitting a conserved current. So the argument I was using before is true for those kind of things. And the problem is that this is not one of those kind of things. All right. So let me just tell you what it is in position space. So let's define delta mu nu of x minus y to be the Fourier transform. So if I take this one term, stick it up into n mu nu here, do these integrals and see what the contribution is to the propagator. That's what delta mu nu is. Yeah. Here? It's three momentum p squared.
So,
yeah.
So that's also non-covariant.
Right. That's how you can see. That's one way to see that this is non-covariant, and it's also non-covariant here. But gauge invariance makes you not care there. Okay. So this is it's going to be minus I over 2 pi to the fourth of the usual factors we would have had. Little d4p divided by p squared minus I epsilon. That's the, if we had combined, the usual story for scalars would be you combine those terms together and you get the p squared minus I epsilon. And these energy, that's the miracle of Feynman rules, right? That one way to think about this 1 over 2p is that this is, if you had been doing quantum mechanical perturbation theory, you would have been doing sums like sum over energies. In perturbation theory, the change of an energy at second order is things like, let's say, n, h interaction, M M H interaction N divided by some energy denominator, right? So it's En minus Em or something like that. These energy denominators, one way to think about that, that's what this is. But the special thing is that you get two terms here, one from the particle, one from the antiparticle, and those are combining to give you what was a very, very non-covariant thing is becoming a covariant thing for the scalar field, and that's giving you the 1 over p squared. So that was the nice thing about covariant Feynman rules was that propagators are combining energy denominators in a nice Lorentz covariant way. So that's what we're finding here. But then the n mu nu term that we want to follow is p squared n mu over 3 momentum squared. So since we're at the end of time, let me just tell you what happens when you do this integral. So you get minus I over 4 pi n mu n nu times delta of x naught minus y naught over x minus y. And so that's the thing that tells you that this could be related to the Coulomb interaction, right? It's something which involves only the correlation of the electromagnetic potential, and it gives you something which is in position space proportional to 1 over the distance between the two positions that are being investigated. So the claim is that if you worked, if you had had an interaction, you know, if your interaction Hamiltonian was minus the integral d3x of j mu a mu plus the Coulomb interaction, then this term in Feynman graphs where this propagator, you know, if you worked a second order in J, say, you'll have things like J mu and propagator A mu of X, A nu of Y, times J nu. So there'll be interactions amongst the currents that are described by propagators at second order. But the Coulomb interaction, you know, the Coulomb interaction, remember, what's the Coulomb interaction? It's just basically two charges interacting with each other. So it's integral d3x of j naught of x, j naught of y, divided by x minus y. That's the Coulomb interaction. So you can kind of see that a second order interaction using this term and this propagator will give you a piece coming from this, which could cancel a first order interaction from this term. So the thing is that this in here cancels that, say, to second order in J. And that's the kind of the miraculous thing that's going on and making things look very simple. So if you knew that cancellation was happening, what you would do is you'd say, well, I take the Gates propagator here, and I wouldn't even write this thing down. I'd say that I have n mu nu, it's equal to, you know, what I would do is I define a new propagator, a covariant propagator. I'm just looking for a board here. So given that cancellation, you can define a covariant propagator. So, which is usually called T star and it would be something which is basically leave out the bad part. So it'll be, you know, it's basically what we've been doing. It'd be something like minus I over 2 pi to the fourth integral d4p over p squared minus I epsilon e to the I p dot x minus y times a to mu nu plus something, I don't care what it is, times p nu plus alpha nu p mu. And not put down the sick term. If you call this propagator your propagator, and if you call this your interaction, the thing that looks nice and covariant, and ignored that, you'd get the same answer for everything. And so the covariance would have been obvious in that case because you've got a covariant interaction and a covariant propagator, and all your rules are covariant, and so things are working well. So the lesson here is that a direct follow your nose calculation isn't doing that. It's giving you this non-covariant piece to the propagator, and it's giving you a non-covariant piece to the interactions, which are canceling, and that cancellation is you might have said, how would you know what to choose here? And canonical quantization will be the thing that tells you how to choose these interactions. And then the path integral will be the thing that tells you, don't even bother following these non-covariant pieces. We'll just directly talk about the interaction Lagrangian, which is the thing that involves this, and the covariant propagation propagator, which is the thing that doesn't involve the sick term. So this is kind of the end of part one. So you've seen there's a sickness. You've seen that the sickness can be fixed by things like the Coulomb interaction, but I haven't shown you yet that the Coulomb interaction really is there. So the way to convince you that this is the right interaction for the QED is to take the Lagrangian for QED and canonically quantize it and find the Hamiltonian, and you can calculate what it is, and the claim will be that this is what it is. And the coefficient of the Coulomb interaction has to be exactly what it has to be to cancel things. So that's probably a good place to stop. No class next week. There is a class Friday, and there's a class on the Tuesday after next week. But